Thank you for tuning into the Talking Information Center. My name is Duncan. Today I'll be reading from the New Republic magazine from March of 2026, my last reading of this month's issues. This article I will read will be entitled Not Your Father's Democrats, submitted by Alex Shepard. Some are left, some aren't, but what they have in common is that they are ready to rumble. It's the Democratic Tea Party with a twist. Janet Mills, the 78-year-old moderate who has served as Maine's governor since 2019, is staid and a little boring, which is exactly why, last fall, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee pushed her to run against progressive upstart Graham Plattner in the state's Senate primary. Mills was reasonably popular and polled well against Susan Collins, the Trump-enabling moderate, who had represented Maine since 1997. Most importantly, she had been in politics a long time. She was first elected to Maine's House of Representatives more than 20 years ago, and therefore had already been vetted. The same could not be said about Plattner, who announced his populist Senate campaign last summer, seemingly out of nowhere. An oyster farmer and a war on terrorism veteran, Plattner was gruff and tough and looked like the answer for a party struggling to reach working-class voters and men. As it turned out, he also carried a ton of baggage. Soon after Mills announced her candidacy, nuclear-grade opposition research began falling. Let's get this out of the way. Graham Plattner isn't a Nazi. He had a Nazi tattoo, sure, but he doesn't anymore. He got it covered up in October, a few days after the world learned about the totem cough symbol he had inked on his chest in Croatia while on military leave 2 decades ago. If one can get a Nazi tattoo innocently, then Plattner almost certainly did. He says he didn't know its true meaning at the time, and there's little reason to doubt him. There is nothing in any of the statements that Plattner has given in town halls, interviews, or other campaign events to suggest that he's a bigot either, though he did write some bad stuff about black people and women on the internet a few years ago. For what it's worth, he also said white rural voters were stupid and racist. When these posts were unearthed, Plattner apologized, citing his PTSD and political and cultural ignorance. Still, it's hard to think of any Democratic campaign that could survive having to make so many disclosures. It's also hard to think of a more lethal, better orchestrated political hit, or one better designed to showcase the value of Democratic power brokers. There was just one problem. Mills had baggage too. The DSCC had no idea. Plattner knew it the moment she entered the race. DC's choice has lost to Susan Collins 5 times in a row, Plattner posted on social media shortly after the DSCC endorsed Mills. We can't afford a sixth. There were no Reddit posts lurking in Mills' past, no fascist tattoos hidden on her body. Instead, she had a different problem. She was endorsed by the Democratic elite. In the first town hall since the oppo started raining down, Plattner apologized to a full house of 600 in Ogunquit, population 1,577 people, and then flipped the script. The machine is turned on because it is scared, he said. The attacks against him, he argued, were relative of a party elite that had lost touch with its voters. If the party was run by the people that were in it, it would be the party you would want it to be. Not so long ago, any one of the scandals Graham Plattner faced in mid-October would likely have sunk his campaign. The race is now up for grabs. If for a while his lead was over 30 points, it has since shrunk significantly. But Plattner is still in the game. Some recent posts suggest that he has at least a small but stubborn advantage, and multiple surveys have indicated that he may be a more formidable challenger to Collins than Maine's current governor. That is partly a result of Plattner's charisma and populist platform, but it's also a result of the growing frustration and anger many Democratic voters feel towards their leaders. Donald Trump's re-election represented the failure of the Democratic establishment, explained Joe Calvello, Plattner's former senior advisor. People who in 2018 or 2020 were taking their cues from party leaders or elders are like, what the hell do these people know that I don't know? They've failed time and time again. Having watched Democratic power brokers lose 2 presidential elections to Trump and control of both houses of Congress, many voters no longer trust them on questions of candidate selection or policy, or anything else for that matter. And if the support of the establishment previously guaranteed a certain level of fundraising, said Rebecca Katz, a political strategist and a co-founder of Fight, a consulting firm working with Plattner, this cycle we're seeing a lot of anti-establishment candidates raising real money off of not being the D.C. favorite. Voters are increasingly suspicious of, if not downright hostile to, candidates who have been vetted feted by a party establishment that keeps getting it wrong. A base that has long made pragmatic, sober decisions appears increasingly attracted to charismatic outsiders who promise to break from the party's failures of the last decade. They see their party's leaders as feckless and inept. They are looking to populists who represent a vastly different approach to politics. The Democratic Tea Party is here. There are many ways to describe the drift of American politics over the last two decades, but one is rather simple. The Republican Party has experienced two related revolutions, the Tea Party in 2009 and the rise of Donald Trump in 2016, that resulted in widespread purges and transformed it into the hardline nativist party it is today. The Tea Party forced out moderate Republicans and anyone who would dare work across the aisle. Trump then pushed out anyone who didn't show absolute loyalty to him. The Democratic Party dealt with a single revolution, Bernie Sanders' insurgent candidacy in 2016, that it only temporarily quelled. In 2017, Democrats had good reasons for turning against party leaders. The bosses had just backed a candidate, after all, who had lost a pivotal election to a racist con man. But voters stuck with them. Maybe the stakes were too high. Maybe the excuses for Hillary Clinton's admittedly fluky loss, Russian interference, an 11th-hour intervention from FBI Director James Comey, Sanders' daring to challenge Clinton at all, were compelling. Though none were as compelling as the fact that the party's nominee, a divisive figure who was synonymous with the political establishment many voters detested, was arguably the worst imaginable person to run against Trump. In any case, during Trump's first term, Democratic voters didn't rebel against their party's status quo. They embraced it. The heroes of the first Trump resistance were almost always establishment figures. They were party elders like Nancy Pelosi, who was 78 when she retook the gavel as Speaker of the House after Democrats won back the chamber in 2019, and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who handed a supermajority to court conservatives when she died at 87 the following year. Many had deep ties to the national security state, such as the former CIA director, John Brennan, and the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper. Some were even Republicans critical of the president, most notably Liz Cheney, a Republican congresswoman and the daughter of Dick Cheney and John Bolton, who briefly served as Trump's national security advisor. In 2020, primary Democratic voters selected Joe Biden, who had served as Obama's vice president and was first elected to the Senate in 1972. When he was sworn into office in January of 2021, he just turned 78. Between 17 and 2021, Democratic voters were eager to promote figures who represented a return to the normal politics of the pre-Trump era. They trusted these elders in part because doing so aligned with a coherent theory of resisting Trump. Deep down, the country wanted respected, sober-minded establishment types to make decisions. They would soon grow tired of the chaos and incoherence and unhinged tweets that define the Trump's administration. It was a reasonable theory to posit that Trumpism was an aberration, said Stuart Stevens, a longtime political strategist and senior advisor to the Lincoln Project. So was Cold Fusion. They both proved to be wrong. On February 5th of 2025, the New Yorker magazine published an article asking a question that was growing more and more common in the media. What happened to the Trump resistance? That piece, published 2 weeks into Trump's second term, accurately noted the lack of widespread dissent, a sharp contrast to the early days of 2017 when across the country millions showed up to women's marches and thousands spontaneously arrived at airports, placards in hand, to protest the Muslim ban. What was going on? Many pundits agreed that the base was shell-shocked. Trump's re-election was direct proof that the first resistance had failed. The fact that he had just won the popular vote, something he failed to do in 2016, pointed to another, related explanation for Democrats' quiescence. 8 years ago, liberals could console themselves that Trump had no popular base of support. There was nothing to soften the blow this time. The Democrats may have rolled out the usual slate of celebrity appearances, Beyonce, Bruce Springsteen, Oprah, but it was Trump who understood the zeitgeist. During his campaign, he embraced influencers and edgy podcasters. After the election, he watched as athletes celebrated goals and touchdowns by dancing like him. The party's long monopoly on popular culture had been shattered. Trump's strong showing among young men and Latino voters, meanwhile, represented a direct refutation of a favored explanation for his first victory, that it stemmed from an economically anxious, racially resentful white base. It was a particularly bitter pill to swallow. Nearly a decade after his political career, many Democrats still didn't understand his appeal. There's an alternative explanation for the languid start of the second Trump's resistance, however. The Democratic base was doing what it usually does, taking cues from its leaders. In the lead-up to Trump's first term, those leaders vowed to fight like hell. In the lead-up to the second, they were pledging to work with the new administration. In late February, James Carville, a fossil who hadn't managed a successful campaign since 1992, argued in the New York Times that the Democrats' best approach was to play dead. During Trump's first term, they channeled the pugilistic spirit of their base and fought back. That, Carville added, was a mistake. Activism had doomed the Democrats. The party's strong message that it is the party of health care and high wages had been muddled by its investigations of Russian election interference and its embrace of progressive policies aimed at racial justice and other social issues. Now, some voters weren't sure what it stood for beyond opposing Trump, while others believed it stood for a smattering of racial radical policies that certain candidates backed during the 2020 Democratic primaries. Those policies came back to haunt the party in 2024 when they were endlessly recycled in attack ads. Carville had a simple, foolproof way to retake power. Sit back, let Trump destroy the country, then swoop in to pick up the pieces. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, seemed to be listening. 2 weeks after Carville published that op-ed, he provided decisive votes to Republicans to continue funding the government. In doing so, he not only caved, he co-signed a check to fund an authoritarian administration. The vote underlined his powerlessness. It also woke up his base. Democrats were furious. I guess we'll find out what extent Schumer is leading the party into irrelevance, Ezra Levin, a co-founder of the group Indivisible, told Politico at the time. Many Democrats seemed to agree. They wanted a fight. Schumer and other party leaders wouldn't give it to them, so they started it themselves. As Trump's abuses multiplied, direct action became more and more common, especially in response to the fascistic immigration raids that were occurring with growing frequency and violence in American cities. And as the second Trump resistance grew, so did its contrast with the behavior of party leaders. By the time millions took to the streets in June as part of the first No Kings protest, it was undeniable. The Democratic base was angry and ready to fight. Its leaders were still playing dead. Meanwhile, a robust and sophisticated network of professional political operatives, including Katz and Calvello, were determined to rescue the party from itself. Many of them were aligned with Bernie Sanders' 2016 primary campaign. Over the last 8 years, they had accrued experience and learned from their mistakes. Plattner, in other words, didn't just walk off a dock on the Maine coast and enter a crucial primary. He was recruited, Plattner later told the New York Times magazine, by a group of organizers who were worried that there was going to be a bad decision made for this race, namely that the DSCC would repeat mistakes it had made back in 2020 when it put all its weight behind Sarah Gideon, who spent millions only to lose badly. Indeed, Plattner's success thus far owes a lot to Gideon's failure. 6 years ago, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee cleared the way for her to run against Collins. With the committee's help, she raised more than $60 million and lost by nearly 9 points, almost exactly the same margin by which Biden won Maine. People remember that and are like, why should I listen to you? Calvello said. They don't care about the gatekeepers telling them. You can't elect this guy. They want something real, and Graham offers that. Plattner's recruiters may not have been aware of the scope of his baggage, but they were certainly aware that it's a remarkably that he is a remarkably deft politician. He endured an October hell by explaining his mistakes and depicting them as a model for regular people, especially men who are struggling. He was once an angry and confused young man, but he changed. For those who are inclined to forgive him, and polling suggests many Maine voters are, it's both a moving story and part of his larger message. If Plattner is advocating for a politics that prioritizes people's dignity and welfare, he's also channeling rage about Trump, the state of the U.S. healthcare system, and an increasingly oligarchic economy in town halls all over Maine that regularly attract hundreds of guests. Mills, by contrast, is seemingly waiting around for the oppo to do its work. Her strategy may yet prove effective, but one reason it hasn't so far is that many voters are no longer taking cues about electability from party leaders. Instead, they want candidates who are not only loudly speaking out about the abuses of the Trump administration, but also explicitly detailing how they would govern differently. Many of the new wave of candidates are, like Plattner, populists and progressives. But not all of them are. Representative Jasmine Crockett, for example, a centrist from Texas, whose description of her former colleague Marjorie Taylor Greene's bleach blonde, bad-built butch body made her an instant star, may win the party's Senate nomination less for her establishment platform than her pugilistic approach to messaging. The common thread uniting these new Democrats is that they're fighters. Their campaigns may pull in Trump voters, as Plattner's is attempting to do, but not by way of carefully tailoring moderation of left bashing or left bashing. Instead, they are guided by a willingness to dispense with focus grouped messaging and conventional wisdom, a healthy skepticism of consultants and other Brahmins of electability, and a knack for getting and keeping attention, both online and in real life. These outsider candidates are building alliances with figures and organizations that were previously aligned with the party's mainstream. When Plattner needed an outlet to address his Nazi tattoo, for example, he chose Pod Save America, a podcast hosted by former Obama staffers. Once dyed-in-the-wool members of the Democratic Party, they are now emblematic of a new cohort of influential figures who are at once aligned with the Democratic Party and increasingly critical of its leadership. The group includes New York Times opinion writer Ezra Klein, liberal wine mom and podcaster Jennifer Welch, Tim Miller of The Bulwark, an outlet founder by Never Trump Republicans that caters to moderates, and more outwardly progressive figures like the leftist streamer Hassan Piker and Zitio News founder Mehdi Hassan. If members don't have much in common beyond a shared intuition that the people running the party don't know what they're doing. Unsurprisingly, one thing they also share is a sense of betrayal at the party's decision to back a deeply unpopular 81-year-old's doomed re-election campaign until the last possible moment. Their emergence owes a great deal to a larger fracturing in organized politics and mass media over the last decade. Just as political parties have lost much of the top-down control they had throughout much of the 20th century, traditional news organizations have also lost much of the influence and power they once had. They have been replaced by more ideological diverse outlets, or in some cases individual commentators, that are less beholden to access to power brokers, official statements, and elite-driven narratives. The result is a political landscape where outsiders can flourish. Indeed, in many cases, it's one where outsiders are preferred, given the pervasive distrust of organized political parties and mass media. This shift has been less pronounced in Democratic-leaning circles than in Republican ones, which have been dominated by outsiders since the rise of the Tea Party nearly 17 years ago. But it is still apparent, as the rise of outsider candidates and outlets in the wake of Trump's re-election in 2024 suggests. The new schism in the Democratic Party is best understood less as an ideological battle than a battle over political approach. The fight is between the politicians, interest groups, and party operators who want to play it safe. The complacent Democrats, let's call them, and the insurgent Democrats who want to hold a lawless administration accountable and take bolder stands on policy. The emergent quasi-alliance supporting them is channeling not only the base's anger at the current administration, but its frustration at its own leaders. What unites them is a larger sense that the establishment's approach to politics in the Trump era has failed. But what should replace it? In November, Zoran Mamdani, a charismatic 34-year-old self-described democratic socialist, won New York City's mayoral election after running a campaign laser-focused on a big theme, the affordability crisis and the concrete policies he would advance to help fight it. Free buses, a rent freeze for 2 million tenants, and a pilot program for city-owned grocery stores were three of the many ideas. If Mamdani was exciting, he was also divisive, relentlessly attacked by the right for his socialist views and his advocacy on behalf of Palestinians. He was hardly embraced by his party's mainstream, even after he defeated former Governor Andrew Cuomo in June's Democratic primary. When voters cast their ballots, he had only just been endorsed by the party's leader in the House, Hakeem Jeffries, who represents a district in Brooklyn. Neither of New York's two Democratic senators, including the party's Senate leader, Chuck Schumer, another Brooklynite, endorsed him. He won anyway, beating Cuomo, then running as an independent a second time. For all of the excitement and attention surrounding Mamdani during main many in the party's mainstream rolled their eyes following his victory. After all, the establishment wing had won big, too. In Virginia and New Jersey gubernatorial elections, Democrats romped to victory by margins that exceeded Mamdani's rumors of the party's demise were exaggerated, it seemed. Then, one week later, Schumer caved again, ending a government shutdown that had dragged on for weeks without garnering any concessions from the administration. The base, which had cheered on the shutdown as a sign that the party's leaders were finally attacking, was furious. The establishment was back where it was in the spring. The most straightforward takeaway from November's elections is that the party's base wants a fight and will respond to any candidate who brings it. Their anger does not appear to be so profound that, as happened with the Tea Party, they will embrace any bomb thrower who promises to burn it all down. Democratic voters still care more about stopping Trump than anything else. Stevens said he hopes Democrats will embrace the fact that the likes of both Mamdani and Josh Shapiro, the moderate governor of Pennsylvania, can win. It's so absurd that the party is losing its mind over a guy who's talking about maybe five city-owned grocery stores and we're nationalizing Intel. In the short term, the result will almost certainly be midterm elections in which both mainstream and outsider candidates win and lose. We can look forward to a bigger tent and an even bigger argument over the direction of the party. Can this new generation of insurgent anti-establishment Democrats win voters over? As primary season slowly kicks into gear, their approach will be tested in Senate primaries like Michigan's, where the establishment-backed Haley Stevens is facing off against two progressive challengers, and in contested primaries in dozens of House districts. Plattner, of course, may very well lose in the primary or the general, and a loss in either race will seemingly vindicate the Democratic Party brokers who have set out to destroy him. But he already demonstrated he has already demonstrated their weakness. He has been speaking for months about the high sky cost of health care and the stagnant growth of wages, yes, but also about a craven political establishment with outdated ideas that shuts out newcomers to protect its own. It's a message that he has consistently delivered to hundreds of people before and after the raft of scandals that threatened to prematurely end his campaign. Can you say the same about Janet Mills or any other establishment Democrat? This article has been submitted by Alex Shepard, who's a senior editor at the New Republic magazine. The next article I will read is entitled The Long Run, submitted by Daniel Schlossman. The left is often able to excite large numbers to protest, and then what? A photograph called Love from the German photographer Wolfgang Tillmann shows a young woman in red lipstick, eyes closed, a man's hands on her head in a nightclub. This image from 1989, which appears on the cover of the historian Anton Yeager's new book, Hyperpolitics, captured a sort of beginning. The weight of history is over and the music can sway. The world, Yeager suggests, is both still with us and long gone. The rich democracies, most of his examples come from Western Europe, though he keeps an eye on the United States, still live in a universe of instant, individualized gratifications. But now, thanks to streaming and delivery, they are largely available at home, making even the thumping nightclub itself an object of nostalgia. Whether it closed in September of 2001, March 2003, or September 2008, the era of post-politics argued by the fall of the Berlin Wall is long over. By the 2010s, history returned and so did large-scale contentious politics, exploding far beyond the staid boundaries of formal institutions. In wave after wave of protest, copycat protest, and counter-protest. Yet, in a fundamental paradox, after all the mass action, little remained in the way of institutional residue or durable victory. For all the differences between Black Lives Matter and Stop the Steal, Yeager writes, and one might add Occupy Wall Street and Roads Must Fall, these movements exhibit a striking set of similarities, fleeting in duration, they maintain so membership's roles and struggle to impose any real discipline on their adherents. Incessant yet uncoordinated excitation makes for a politics that raises hopes only soon to dash them. The two major factors Yeager sees as shaping the political landscape are, then, the politicalization of society and the institutionalization of politics. Our present era of hyperpolitics is simultaneously politicized, but not institutionalized. The placid years after 1989 were low on both dimensions. By contrast, the age of mass parties and thick civil society was high on both. A richer and more totalizing associational world encompassing parties all the way from fascism fascist to conservative to socialist to communist, in times more heroic and tragic than our own benighted present. Hyperpolitics, Jaeger argues, poses a larger problem for the left than for the right. Here's the analysis picks up from the previous book, The Populist Movement, an unsparing account of the left populist revival written with Arthur Barriello. If the right's most perfervid dreams are yet to be fulfilled, right populist marches forward nonetheless. Whether the right owes its relative success to the last embers of social cohesion that remain in police unions, gun clubs, and the like, or simply finds voters amid social anomaly and the aftermath of failed counter-mobilizations, the left requires what Antonio Gramsci called a collective will, which has already been recognized and has come to extent asserted itself in action. And that is nowhere to be found. Instead, the left's hyperpolitical mobilization detonates like a neutron bomb. A moment ago, thousands of people were protesting in a square. Now they have vanished, with the assailed power infrastructure intact. The United States, with its fragmented political system and its overheated attention economy, has proven particularly susceptible to hyperpolitics. Belgian-born, UK-based Jaeger is not the first foreigner to be dazzled by the sheer over-the-topness of political politics in America, marveling at WWE wrestlers and country stars pledging to physically shield their candidate from harm at the RNC, and Georgia rappers counting down to state announcements at the DNC. But neither does he treat the election of Donald Trump as an exceptional moment in the country's history or the anti-democratic features of the American Constitution as a suitable explanation for our present discontents. Besides, hyperpolitics is far from unique to the United States. As his examples show, variations on the same story recur in parliamentary and presidential systems, and with first-past-the-post and proportional electoral systems. Institutional reforms might help, but deep explanations lie elsewhere. What gives the book its bite is its reading of Putnam from the left. In Bowling Alone, the Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam traced how the decline of community groups and civic ties in the United States has produced an atomized polity. For Putnam, writing in any one of the post-politics era, the story was about civil society itself. He evinced little interest in union decline, neoliberalism, or the changing characteristics of capitalism. Nor, beyond noting falling rates of voter turnout, did he pay much heed to the decline in party's presence on the ground. A commission of worthies under Putnam's leadership, whose most notable members was an Illinois state governor named Barack Obama, offered 100 things you can do to build a social capital. Among them, hold a neighborhood barbecue and give your park a weatherproof checkers board. For Jaeger, the loosening of social ties that Putnam identified explains not only declining institutionalization with the erosion of unions and the disappearance of the thick organizational culture around mass parties, but also just why increased politicization would fail to stick into durable organization and why that would hurt the left. This is a story not just of the endless scroll of clickable content, but also of the wasteland of sociability, a void in the place of the associations that had forged politics and class consciousness. Jaeger quotes the Hungarian philosopher Gaspar Miklós Tamás' observation that the counterpower of working-class trade unions and parties was undergirded by their own savings banks, health and pension funds, newspapers, extramural popular academics, working man's clubs, libraries, choirs, brass bands, engagé intellectuals, songs, novels, philosophical treaties, etc., all with their own mores, manners, and styles. These social worlds formed political loyalties far thicker and more durable than anything on offer today outside a few religious groups, melding deep communities with ongoing social and community ties. Skipping forward in the article due to time constraints, Jaeger writes very much as a millennial socialist. The 2010s left's heady moments arrived as youthful exuberance, and the disappointments of the 2020s manifest as generational angst, not just political frustration. Today's defenders of institutions and the virtues of community typically congregate on the soggy ground of nostalgia for bipartisan or, more broadly, trans-ideological comity, however bitter their denunciations of Trumpism. Institutions tamp down conflict rather than pointing it in a given direction. What gives hyperpolitics its bracing quality despite all the preening is that Yeager turns that familiar formulation around. With grand ambitions to theorize a left that can win, he rediscovers the radical possibilities in institutional thinking. This article has been submitted by Daniel Schultzman, reviewing the book. Thank you for listening in. My name's Duncan. That's all the time I have for today. Thank you for tuning in to the Talking Information Center.